Greetings and bibulatory ejaculations, my proto-anarchically vulgarinous listeners, and welcome to this June 2019 Science News Update. I'm your host for this completely puerile science podcast segment, Jim Campanella. So, we are going to go back to the standard old format this month. So much so that, yes, I'm going to start with Idiot Scientist of the Month. Unfortunately, it's very sad, but we're going to return to the story of Jian Kuhi of China. I thought we were over and done with that story. I had the mistaken belief that he was off the board and could do no more harm than he has already done. And of course, as I am much of the time, I was wrong. He may be done with his public research and may be locked up by the Chinese government, but he is still reaching out and making lives more crappy. Now that takes real talent. For those of you who are not regular listeners and do not remember Jian Kuhi, the man shocked the world last year by editing the genomes of two twin girls. He explained that the DNA edits would protect the babies against HIV infection once they grew up. And to do this, he edited their DNA and altered an HIV receptor protein in the girls called CCR5 so it would not allow HIV to attach to it. Not only was this brain-dead reason for messing with human genomes widely denounced by the scientific community as utterly unethical and kind of pointless, but new research suggests that the mutations may actually shorten the lives of the poor girls who are his victims. This is just wrong, and it upsets me quite a bit. The new paper was published in Nature Medicine and is entitled CCR5 Delta 32 is deleterious in the homozygous state in humans. The work came out of the lab of Dr. Rasmus Nielsen of UC Berkeley, and his group employed genotyping and death register information from 409,000 individuals in the UK Biobank to investigate fitness effects of the CCR5 Delta 32 mutation. In other words, he checked to see how well did people survive who had the same mutation that that idiot he put into those little girls. Well, studying the record, Nielsen found that people who had two mutated copies of the gene had a significantly higher death rate between the ages of 41 and 78 than those with one or no copies. The authors estimate, quote, there is a 21% increase in the mortality rate in individuals who are homozygous for the Delta 32 allele, unquote. Nielsen says specifically, beyond many ethical issues involved with the CRISPR babies, the fact is, right now, with current knowledge, it is still very dangerous to try to introduce mutations without knowing the full effects of what those mutations do. In this case, it is probably not a mutation that most people would want to have. You are actually, on average, worse off having it. So previous studies have associated two mutated copies of that gene, CCR5, with a fourfold increase in the death rate after an influenza infection, and higher overall mortality rate may reflect this greater susceptibility to death from flu. But the researchers say there could be any number of explanations, since the protein CCR5 codes for, and which no longer works in those having a mutation in the copies, is involved in lots of body functions. Nielsen adds, quote, because one gene could affect multiple traits, and because, depending on the environment, the effects of a mutation could be quite different, I think there can be many uncertainties and unknown effects in any germline editing, unquote. CCR5 codes for a protein that, among other things, sits on the surface of immune cells and helps some strains of HIV, including the most common ones, to enter and infect them. Naturally occurring mutations that disable the protein are rare in Asians, but a mutation found in about 11% of Northern Europeans protects them against HIV infection. The genetic mutation Delta 32 refers to a missing 32 base pair segment in the CCR5 gene. That mutation interferes with the localization on the cell surface of the protein for which CCR5 codes and keeps HIV from binding and infection, He was unable to duplicate the natural mutation, but he appears to have generated a similar deletion that would also inactivate the protein. One of the babies was reported to have a single copy of CCR5 modified, and the other had both copies edited. Nielsen finishes with, quote, "But inactivating a protein found in all humans and most animals is likely to have negative effects. Here's a functional protein that we all know has an effect in an organism, and it is well conserved among different species. So it is likely that a mutation that destroys the protein is, on average, not good for you. Otherwise, evolutionary mechanisms would have destroyed that protein a long time ago." Unquote. Duh. If a protein has a long, evolved, and conserved function, you don't just kill the function of it and get rid of it. I better go on to the next story before I start screaming. This is awful. Let's move away from biology for a second so I can cool my jets. Yeah. So one of the big questions that physicists have asked for several decades is, where do heavy elements come from? Now, this may seem like a strange or stupid question, since we just look around and they're buried all over the Earth, right? Gold, silver, platinum, they're just there. Well, it's not quite that simple. Nothing is ever quite that simple. They are not just there. The source of lighter elements like carbon, oxygen, and iron is easy. They form inside stars before being spewed out in stellar explosions called supernovas. This is where the quote comes from, "We are made of star stuff." Well, carbon, oxygen, iron, and elements like that are what we are made of. But to create elements further down the periodic table, an extreme environment densely packed with neutrons is required. That's where a chain of reactions known as the R process occurs, in which atomic nuclei rapidly absorb neutrons and undergo radioactive decay to create new elements. Yeah, kind of sounds like Harry Potter alchemy, but that's where heavy elements come from. Dr. Brian Metzger of Columbia University and his research group have recently published a hypothesis of where those heavy elements could have arisen. The paper was published May 8th in the journal Nature. The paper suggests that heavy elements like gold, platinum, and uranium may have formed in special stars called collapsars. These are rapidly spinning massive stars that collapse into black holes as their outer layers explode in a rare type of supernova. A disk of materials swirling around the new black hole as it feeds can create the conditions necessary for that astronomical alchemy that I mentioned earlier. Metzger says, quote, "Black holes in these extreme environments are fussy eaters. They can gulp down only so much matter at a time, and what they don't swallow blows off in a wind that is rich in neutrons. Just the right conditions for the creation of heavy elements." Unquote. It was thought until recently that colliding neutron stars could be the source of heavy metals, but it turns out they just don't produce enough. Metzger says that collapsars can occur shortly after stars begin to form, and that the phenomenon could be a much more prolific producer of heavy elements. A single collapsar might generate 30 times as much R-process material as a neutron star merger, and could generate a few hundred times the Earth's mass in gold. The researchers report that collapsars might be responsible for 80% of the R-process elements in the universe, with neutron star mergers only making up about the last 20%. Next story, and frankly this one terrifies me. Sunscreen may be a two-edged sword. Let me explain what I mean. On May 6th, researchers at the FDA revealed the results of a small clinical trial designed to test how four of the most common sun-filtering molecules on the market behave when they've been sprayed on or rubbed in. The results, published in the Journal of the American Medical Association, show that contrary to what sunscreen manufacturers have been saying, UV-blocking chemicals do seep into our circulation. Now, don't freak out and toss your tubes of sunscreen quite yet. There's no evidence, so far, that they're doing anything harmful inside the body. But the revelation will have serious impacts on sunscreen manufacturers from this point going forward. and may change what options you're going to find on the drugstore shelves before the year is out. Primary researcher Dr. Teresa Michel, director of the FDA's Division of Non-Prescription Drugs, says, quote, "Everyone had always thought that because these are intended to work on the surface of the skin, that they wouldn't be absorbed. But they are," unquote. Michelle's team found that it only took a few hours after the application of sunscreen for the chemicals to infiltrate the bloodstream and shoot up to concentrations above the FDA's toxicology threshold. Doesn't that make you feel all warm inside? The researchers saw the same patterns in all 24 of the volunteers they recruited, 12 men and 12 women, who were randomly assigned to apply one of four commercially available sunscreens, two sprays, a lotion, and a cream. The participants applied their potions according to the recommended labeling, four times a day for 4 days to 75% of their bodies, roughly the amount of skin you'd be showing in a bathing suit. For those 4 days and 3 days after, the researchers collected blood every few hours to be analyzed for the presence of avobenzone, oxybenzone, octocrylene, and N-capsule. They discovered that while it took only a few hours for the UV-blocking chemicals to spike over the target for three of the four formulations, those levels remained elevated through to the end of the study, 3 days after the participants had ceased spraying and smearing the stuff on. Only the cream users saw their chemical concentrations trail off sooner. All this means that sunscreen companies are going to be very unhappy in the future. To prove that they're safe and effective, the FDA is now asking U.S. sunscreen makers to submit additional data measuring how these ingredients are absorbed into the blood. If they don't absorb above the toxicological threshold, then it's not an issue. And if they do, the FDA wants to see more tests. If U.S. manufacturers fail to conduct absorption studies and provide that data to the FDA by the time the agency's new rules are finalized in November, it could mean, in theory, the removal of those products from shelves. Only two ingredients so far have been ruled safe and effective, zinc oxide and titanium dioxide, and those go back like 150 years. The FDA has said they will grant deferrals to the companies willing to commit to undertaking the necessary studies for the remaining 12 molecules in question. The next story of the night is a dark, nasty piece of news for the medical community and patients alike across the world, probably more dire than the measles epidemic in the U.S. It appears that antibiotic resistance has been found in wild bacteria to the antibiotic of last resort. The recently reported identification of the MCR9 gene is scary as blazes. This is a novel bacterial gene that confers resistance against the antibiotic colistin. Colistin is one of the world's few last resort antibiotics. The new paper was published this month in the journal MBio, and the work was done in the lab of Dr. Martin Weidman of Cornell University. The newly discovered gene, MCR9, belongs to a class of plasmid-borne genes that confer resistance to colistin. To date, there are 8 MCR homologs that have been described. Weidman's group found MCR9 in the bacterium Salmonella enterica while screening Salmonella for antimicrobial resistance genes. Well, I guess they succeeded. Weidman said that, quote, "This last resort antibiotic has been designated a highest priority antibiotic by the United Nations World Health Organization, and the MCR9 gene causes bacteria to resist it. In treatments, if colistin does not work, it literally could mean death for patients," unquote. It seems to be that colistin is one of the only therapies left for treating serious bacterial infections in critically ill patients. Until recently, bacterial resistance to colistin was thought to be acquired solely via chromosomal point mutations. That is, until plasmid-mediated colistin resistance genes were described in E. coli. MCR9 is the latest in this new series of mobilized colistin resistance genes. What does that mean, mobilized? Well, it means that mobilized gene can be carried on a plasmid, plasmid is a small circular piece of DNA that can be passed around between bacteria, from bacteria to bacteria, like a bunch of teenagers kind of passing around a bong. The paper says, quote, plasmid-borne MCR genes that confer resistance to colistin pose a threat to public health at an international scale, as they can be transmitted via horizontal gene transfer and have the potential to spread globally, unquote. Weedman finishes with, quote, if you go to a hospital and this gene is floating around, it can be real trouble. The gene is movable. It jumps. In a hospital setting, being able to screen a patient for resistance allows doctors and nurses to isolate the patient and maintain biosecurity. Therefore, the establishment of a complete reference of MCR-type genes that can be used to screen for plasmid-mediated colistin resistance is essential for developing effective control strategies, unquote. Next story in the queue? The United States sucks. Okay, yeah, I know. I have an international audience here, so the question on all your minds is, well, Dr. Camp, sure the United States sucks, but why does the United States suck this time? Here's why. A study suggests that compared with other global agricultural powerhouses, the U.S. has just about the laxest restrictions there are on potentially harmful pesticides. Dr. Nathan Donnelly with the Center for Biological Diversity reports these findings in the June 7th issue of Environmental Health. An analysis of agricultural pesticide regulations reveals that the United States widely uses several chemicals that are banned or being phased out in the European Union, Brazil, and China, three of the world's other leading pesticide users. Donnelly reviewed the approved status of over 500 pesticides that have been used in the United States. Currently, 72 pesticides approved in the United States are banned or being phased out in the European Union, Brazil, and China. These include chemicals that have been implicated in pesticide poisonings in the U.S., like chloropicrin and paraquat. Using the U.S. Geological Survey's record of estimated annual pesticide use, Donnelly determined how much U.S. agriculture uses pesticides outlawed elsewhere. And of the 544 million kilograms of pesticides used in the country in 2016, almost 200 million of that comprised chemicals banned in the EU, Brazil, and China. Since the EPA was formed in 1970, 134 pesticides have been discontinued in the U.S. The EPA prohibited 37 of those, and only 5 in the last 18 years. Pesticide manufacturers voluntarily withdrew the other 97. In many cases, this is likely because the pesticides sold poorly, and it's expensive to maintain EPA approval. That's what Donnelly suggests. Several chemicals showed a steep decline in usage before cancellation. The imbalance between voluntary cancellations and government regulations creates a bias toward pesticide use in the U.S. based on economic factors, rather than health and environmental risks. Voluntary phase-outs can also drag out far longer than the one-year grace period typical of government-imposed bans, Donnelly says. Here's the last story of the evening. In the past, I have mentioned studies that suggest if you use anti-heartburn medicines that reduce acid, you might be opening yourself up to more infections as you potentially kill off some of the good microfauna in your gut. But it appears that a recent study suggests that those acid reducers may be, well, way worse than we thought in the long run. Scientists have now linked long-term use of a common class of heartburn drug with fatal cases of cardiovascular disease, chronic kidney disease, and upper GI cancer. Proton pump inhibitor drugs, PPIs, suppress the production of gastric acid and are routinely prescribed to treat heartburn and ulcers and acid reflux. As I reported previously, Prior research has suggested that prolonged use of these drugs has adverse health effects. However, results from the new study involving more than 200,000 U.S. veterans has clarified which causes of death are linked to taking PPI for long periods, and highlight the need to increase awareness of the potential risks and to reduce unnecessary use of these drugs. Dr. Ziad Al-Ali of Washington University's School of Medicine in St. Louis published this paper in the British Medical Journal this month. Al-Ali says that, quote, taking PPIs over many months or years is not safe, and now we have a clearer picture of the health conditions associated with long-term PPI use. Here's the real problem. This is a very commonly used drug. PPIs are prescribed to more than 15 million people in the U.S., and millions more purchase PPIs over the counter and continue to take the acid-suppressing drugs over the long term without any medical supervision. That includes many blood relatives of mine, since gastric reflux seems to run in my family. Multiple studies have linked PPI use to serious effects, including infections and cardiovascular disease and kidney disease and pneumonia. Prior research by Al-Ali's group found PPI users are at an increased risk of mortality. What hasn't been understood is which specific causes of death might be associated with taking PPIs. The paper says, quote, we have finally produced a detailed quantitative analysis of the specific causes of mortality that can be attributed to taking PPIs, unquote. To look at this in more detail, the team turned to medical records held in the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs database, and they looked at data acquired between 2002 and 2004, and they identified 157,000 people, primarily Caucasian men aged 65 and older, who had been newly prescribed PPIs, and another 56,000 who had been newly prescribed a different type of acid-suppressing drug known as the H2 blocker. All 214,000 patients were then followed up for the next 10 years. After controlling for potentially confounding factors, the researchers found a 17% increase risk of death in the PPI group when compared with the H2 blocker group. Death rates for PPIs were 387 per 1,000 people, and death rates for H2 blockers were 342 per 1,000. This equated to an extra 45 deaths attributable to long-term PPI use per 1,000 people. Al-Ali comments on this result by saying, quote, given the millions of people who take PPIs regularly, this translates into thousands of excess deaths every year, unquote. When the researchers looked at specific causes of death, they found that PPI use was linked with deaths caused by cardiovascular disease, chronic kidney disease, and upper GI cancer. When I read that, my immediate response was, what? I thought people took these drugs to reduce the probability of getting lower esophageal cancer. And what, now they're getting upper GI cancer instead? I don't know. All of this makes me wonder whether stomach acid isn't probably more of a good thing to have, at least at normal levels. The study also found that more than half of the people in the PPI group were prescribed drugs without any documented gastrointestinal indication that would suggest the drugs were medically required. That was the other point at which I said, what? Among that group of individuals, PPI-related death rates were even higher from heart disease and chronic kidney failure and stomach cancer than they were in the other group. These are really ugly statistics. Al-Ali says of this, quote, most alarming to me is that serious harm may be experienced by people who are on PPIs but may not need them. Overuse is not devoid of harm, unquote. Another finding is that prolonged use of even low doses increases the risk of death. This suggests that any prescription of PPI should be limited to patients for whom the benefits will outweigh the risks, and for as short a treatment time as possible. There should also be more effort to be made to make people more aware of the potential dangers of using PPIs over the long term. Al-Ali finishes the paper with, quote, efforts to target and reduce prolonged use of prescription PPIs without indications and to curtail extended use of over-the-counter PPIs might be a good approach, unquote. Oh, man. I'm just happy no one has implicated Tums in all this as being dangerous. I stopped using PPIs a while back, but I don't know what I'd do without my Tums. Well, that's all for me for now. Ask your doctor if PPIs are right for you. Stay out of the sun entirely if you're a sunscreen addict. Avoid bacterial infections, since your options seem to be running out. Keep watching the skies. And I hope I've inspired some of you. Until next time, this is Jim Campanella.